Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I am responsible for it all. I'm Al Warren. Joining me in the co-host seats today, it's crowded, but it's good. We've got Eric Shapiro, or the doctor, from the San Francisco area. I'm good. How are you?
Good. I've been pretty good. I haven't been on in a while, so I'm excited.
Yeah, you've been writing a lot of articles. I've seen you
all that stuff, yeah.
Making the news. You're sure causing problems.
Yeah, I try. You know, the more I try and keep it level, the more things get stirred up. So I have no instinct for it.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's good. Keep them talking. And now from the East Coast, we've got Michael Hawley, Mr. Jack the Ripper himself.
Hello, Al.
Yeah. Hey, I was thinking you are old enough to be Jack the Ripper.
Well, you know, one of my fiction novels was The Elixir of Life, and that Jack the Ripper's still around. So. Just don't tell anybody that's nonfiction, really.
I'm not touching that. Okay. Today we've got, looks like a great guest. She's written a lot of good books here. So, Christy Cherish, thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Now, Christy, you've got quite the history here. What got you into writing, first of all?
a happy accident, I think, is the best description. I'm science research lab trained, so be ending up in the fiction writer's chair was not. If I had been told when I started university that's where I was going to end up, I would have looked a little sideways. I was in a research genetics lab up in Canada here, so up at the University of British Columbia. And long story short, I always loved fiction. I love video games, fiction, sci-fi fantasy particularly. And I was always reading and playing video games while I was also doing research, so on the microscopes and things. And as I appear, you know, sort of approached the very end of my research degree, I realized that I loved research. I loved being in a lab. I loved doing all the genetic stuff, but I was probably not the most well-suited scientist for a teaching position, which was where I was headed. That's kind of the career path. And so I started playing this fantasy game in my head of, well, if I could have any job on the planet and it would just be fun, what would it be? And for me, it was really fun to be a fiction author. And so while I was writing up my PhD thesis, I also was writing up, I was doing some fun creative writing. And by the time I ended up defending my PhD, I also had my first fiction novel, which then I ended up getting an agent for, and then Simon & Schuster picked up. So that ended up being a very long story, not made short, but hey.
Well, yeah, no, but it's interesting because you probably went into science for your love of science, right?
Yeah, I ended up there. I envy people who knew exactly what they wanted to do in university. Like, I know some people who wanted to be doctors, and I know people who wanted to be, you know, teachers, you know, whatever. And I started off university kind of wanting to be Indiana Jones. So of course I ended up in archaeology, and, you know, like many first year archaeology students, that's kind of what I figured, you know, if you stuck around long enough. Despite the fact that on the first day they tell you it's not Indiana Jones. I think every first year archaeology class goes out of their way to say this is not Indiana Jones. But I think there's a subset of us who figure, well, if I just stick around long enough, maybe. Again, through just going through the courses and going through class, I realized pretty quickly that archaeology, and this is back in the 90s now, but archaeology was probably also not the best spot for me. You know, it's and part of finding that out was at Simon Fraser, we had a very famous primatologist who was teaching first year anthropology, and she was a Brutic Albicus. So if you think about primatology, you think about Diane Fossey, Jane Goodall. Brutic Albicus was the third one who was working on orangutans. And so we did get the core elements of anthropology, but we also got this amazing class of sort of that human evolution and, you know, introduction to primatology. And from there, it just kind of catapulted me into genetics and evolution and that sort of thing. So again, it wasn't the first place I thought I would end up.
Wow. So you write these like modern day Indiana Jane. So do you go out in the jungle and practice all your scenes?
You know, I wish. I think all my practice comes from video games. So like you know, of course some of the great RPGs out there, but the one I would think of is, what is it? Drake series, Uncharted, where it's very much an Indiana Jones game. So that's where I get to practice my scenes.
That's pretty interesting. And you bring in supernatural monsters, is what you're saying, temperamental dragons and stuff. So where does that all come from for you? Do you have like a supernatural sort of experiences or background or interest? Like, how do you tie that into everything?
I think because I was in the sciences for so long, I always gravitated towards sci-fi and fantasy because of the escapism aspect. And you know, so there's definitely that. You know, monsters and supernatural gives you kind of a nice separation from the real world, which is kind of cathartic. You know, when you're working on genetics and things that relate to cancer and mutations and things, I often found out that people are in escape. I think there's also a real design challenge that comes into it too. So, you know, again, as a scientist, it's like, how do I make, you know, vampires and dragons and things like that don't exist. But there's a real challenge in, okay, so how do I make this plausible enough So someone will suspend their disbelief, you know, to turn the page. And I think that kind of a challenge appeals to a lot of scientists who end up in sci-fi and fantasy.
Yeah, it made me think of, I know Michael Crichton was really big on that, right? That was like, you know, for the group back, dinosaurs. We have, the science has to hold as much water as possible. So is that something you try and do in the, what's the word, verisimilitude? Like it has to be as realistic as possible?
Yeah, you know, as real as, it always depends on the story. If you're doing something that very, I absolutely agree on Michael Crichton. He was kind of a master because he was a medical, he went to medical school. Honestly. I'm not sure if he was ever a medical doctor, but yeah, like, I mean, his, he really brought his expertise so well to his novels. You know, it's, there's the interesting thing about urban fantasy is, I think a lot of writers who start off in it, it looks deceptively like, fantasy life in, or world building life, because you kind of can use your urban modern fantasy. It, you know, there's city, there's cabs, there's cars, there's the internet usually. So on the surface, it looks fairly, you know, a little, it looks like you're taking, not a shortcut, but you're cutting out some of the work because you don't have to build an entire continent or, you know, an entire world. But on the other hand, you have to make it blend in with the cityscape. How, you know, what a vampire is going to do in a modern world. I think the tone, like as I said, the tone too also will affect how much you can get away with. So if I have something that's very spoofy and, you know, it's very tongue in cheek, like sort of a adventure Indiana Jones, there's a lot more you can get away with. When you get into the more noir, you know, and the more serious mysteries, or, you know, a more serious tone of mystery, then I find personally you have a little less leeway because, you got to find different ways to blend things in. I think it's, I think every author loves those kinds of world building challenges.
So it depends on the genre or subgenre, because you're always doing, the fantasy element is always intact throughout the stories, but if it's more noir, it sort of indicates more emotional seriousness, so it can't be as freewheeling and soft. So it's, that's interesting. But do you prefer to bring your scientific strengths to it, or sometimes you just prefer to cut loose and have more fun with the imagination side of it?
A little bit of both. One of the things that surprised me when I first was getting feedback from my editor, I originally didn't think I was putting much science into my urban fantasies. I was kind of, you know, I wasn't putting in genetics, and I certainly wasn't putting in codes like Michael Crichton was in Jurassic Park. I was definitely in the fantasy realm. But one of the feedbacks I got was that there, to somebody who's not a scientist, or hasn't had that introduction, there actually was a lot in there. And I think part of it is because I was in sciences for so long, and that's where the bulk of my training is. It's impossible to check what you know at the door when you go into writing a novel. There are just things now that I take for granted, like genetics. So in an accidental way, there ends up being a lot of genetics in my in most of my works, just in the day to day of how does something work, or cell biology with proteins. And it's not really something I think of, but it sort of ends up in the makeup, or the fiber of my novels.
So Christy, this is Mike. The other thought about that is, like, for me, I had my master's thesis was in fossil stratigraphy and paleontology. So when I was doing that, it was really quite intense what we were doing. So what I would do on the side would be write on my fiction novels. And it sounded so similar that you had your first fiction novel when you were doing that. Were you kind of like doing that on purpose so you can kind of think two different places? Because your brain was so much in one side, and then you kind of switch off and on?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that's interesting that you were doing a very similar, it sounds like you're doing a very similar thing where you were doing, you know, both at the same time. I found with, you know, it was kind of fun writing. With any kind of journal articles or, you know, thesis work, my experience with it was that it was a very restricted, formal language that that we had to use for cell biology and the genetics, papers that we were, journals that we were aiming for. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a real, there's almost like a set of rules that you're learning when you learn how to do a journal article, because you've got to have it laid out. You've got to have the experimental methods laid out a certain way. You got to have the, you know, there's a certain language that everybody's adopted for how do you report this kind of result. So in some ways the fiction writing was quite freeing for me because I felt like I could actually write in a way where I was communicating with, more than the 10 other people on the planet who worked in, you know, on my gene or my cell process that I was interested in. So I think it was the fun aspect, but also just being able to write something that I could give to, my parents or a friend, and they'd actually understand what I was trying to say. So, there's kind of both of those there. One of the things that I found was that I'd be curious with your science background if you found the same. There's a very similar or a parallel process in writing where the thought process, the experimental method, you know, you come up with your hypothesis, you then start testing your hypothesis. You put together your experiments, and then depending on your results, you continue the story of that scientific question, that topic that you're writing about. And I find that those, that sort of thought structure of, you know, translates to me in what I'm trying to write. You know, my hypothesis is, well, let's try this story out. And my experimental methods are, well, let's try these scenes. And, you know, once I've written these scenes, do I believe the characters? Do I buy the story I'm spinning? And continue it that way. And depending on the results of those scenes, that tells me the next scene or experiment that I need to put these characters into. The thing that I loved about fiction was when I was doing an experiment, there's also a real creativity to science that I think gets undersold because, people always talk about the memorization of sciences, but when you get to that experimental process, you're asking questions that you don't actually know the answers to. You've got a lot of background information that you can form educated guesses from, but you don't really know. So there's a creative component that comes into imagining what your results might be and what questions you need to ask. And I find that I found that when I first started writing, one of the things that really appealed to me was that all of a sudden I could make up the ending to my experiment. I actually had a little more control over them. Whereas, you know, when you're doing an experiment in the real world, you have no control over the results. And that's part of the scientific discipline is that you've got to, you've got to look past what you want the story's outcome to be and see what's actually on the table in front of you.
Wow. Now, this is part of this newest book we're talking about, Owl and the Tagger Thieves. So this is book 4. What is the Owl series for someone that's never read any of them?
Yeah, so OWL and the OWL, The Adventures of OWL, is a series about a archaeology grad student turned international antiquities thief who reluctantly has to navigate the supernatural world. She has one rule: no supernatural jobs, and that kind of goes out the window almost immediately when a dragon who runs a casino in Las Vegas offers her a deal she just can't refuse. And so it's I aspired to do a fun adventure novel, and you know, it's like any writer out there, you can cross your fingers and hope you succeed. But that was kind of what I was going for, and that's kind of what it's hopefully what readers find it's about.
Then you've been with Simon and Schuster from the beginning, it looks like. Haven't they been carrying all these titles?
Yeah, they have. Simon and Schuster did we did four books, and then I have a separate series actually with Random House. A second paranormal series, yeah.
So how is it? So you're playing with the majors. You have these very prestigious publishers. How has that experience been?
It's been fantastic. I was very, very lucky that things aligned, that I was able to work with some amazing editors. Not having the MFA background, and the writing background, having the science background, what was great was I ended up getting a very good introduction to the discipline of writing. It kind of felt like I was doing a master class working with the in-house editors. So yeah, no, it's been a very positive experience for me, and it really of course ended up being a crash course in publishing and marketing and just how that entire world works.
Do they take care of a lot of the marketing, Lisa, or is it sort of split labor, or how's that work?
My experience is, and publishing is changing a lot right now, is a lot of it is they do the editing, the covers, and editing covers, titles, interestingly enough. Those are things you really don't have that much control over when you're working in-house. And they do the lion's share of the marketing and publicity. I think everybody now every author now is expected more to do, with social media and with, social media, the internet. The expectation is that you're also out there doing things. And you also see a lot of hybrid authors now, which was something 10 years ago that was, even 5 years ago, that just wasn't as common. So a lot of people already who do end up with these publishing deals also have their own way of doing it, where they've already got their own processes and marketing, marketing sort of set things that they like to do in place. So it ends up being a bit of both.
When you say hybrid, you mean that part of their list is self-published? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Amazing. That used to be very taboo. Go ahead.
Yeah, it absolutely. When I was first starting off in writing, it absolutely was taboo. And you were warned, whatever you do, don't put a book up. If you can't sell it to a publisher, please, whatever you do, don't put it up online. And now that's completely changed. It's like, if you don't have a book that maybe gets picked up by one of the big five, I guess it's, I used to say big six, but I think it might only be big five or big four now, because they keep condensing themselves. I know authors who have, it runs the gamut, because I know authors who have self-published in the U.S., but Random House Germany publishes their title in Germany, and then, wow, or in various other languages in other countries. And then I know people who have the ebook rights, they publish the ebook, but the print rights are held by one of the big players.
Right.
And or Audible. Yeah. So and I also know authors who have now started getting back their who had the their novels were picked up and published by one of the big house sub brands, and you know, a couple of years later, the ebook rights are being given back to them, and then they're self-publishing now online.
Right.
So it's all over the place.
It is. To my understanding, like a company like a country like Germany, for example, or maybe Japan or even Italy or Russia, like you could, if you're publishing in the U.S. at a high enough level of sales, then countries like those will pay a pretty handsome fee for the rights to publish in their territory. So I know a couple of authors that, to the best of my understanding, they do okay in the United States. Like it's sufficient, but where their income is really coming from is when they sell those foreign rights, and that's what sustains them. So they need to just be adequate in the U.S. And then does that sound about right?
Yeah, it depends on the author. It depends on your audience. It also just sometimes is a bit of a luck. There are authors who do incredible on Audible. For whatever reason, they got the right narrator, the right time. Whose series is it? Another Canadian author I can highly recommend in the sci-fi wing, the Bobiverse series.
Okay.
It originally would not sell to, I don't have the author's name in front of me, so apologies, it slips my mind, but it's, I think it's been a New York Times bestseller now, through the Audible platform and ebooks. But originally that book wasn't picked up by any of the big publishers, and self-publishing and then the Audible version just took off like wildfire. So it's been an international success and a really great series. So it's, it's, you just don't know what's going to happen and what's going to stick, which is why everybody should just keep writing.
Right, right. It sounds like it's on the author to a certain extent, especially like you were saying with social media. The author has to be sure that they're operational as a persona and that there's an ongoing marketing framework of some kind or another. But whether it comes down to self-publishing or traditional publishing or hybrid is all going to, like you said, depend on the audience, depend on the nature of the content, and it really is. There's no formula anymore.
No, there doesn't seem to be. And, you know, it's also there's also this component that the overnight success, especially in, I think, North America, we love that. And in, Western Europe as well, there's that, everybody loves that overnight success. And one of the ones that always sticks in my head is, the stories that I used to read about, probably back 15 years or so now, but, when J.K. Rowling was the Harry Potter series was getting really big, I would read these news articles before I was writing about how she would be writing, on napkins and yeah. In a coffee shop or something, and sort of portrayed as this overnight success. And that was the case. She was working very hard on it, trying to get the novel sold. And I think, we kind of gravitate towards that story, but often it's decades and decades of, it can be decades of work. Sometimes you do get those just.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Luminary starts, and that first book out of the gate is some kind of, there's almost like a zeitgeist element around it, where it takes off. But the vast majority of authors out there, another very famous series, and another wonderful American author, Charlene Harris, the Sookie Stackhouse series. She was, which of course got picked up as a series on HBO, which was True Blood. She had been a mystery writer for years and years. And one of the stories, I don't know how true this story is, but it's one of those, stories that's been passed around at conferences, is that she joked once on a panel that, she was an overnight success. When she wasn't, she had been working at it for a very long time. Just there was that moment where everything aligned and she became a household name.
Yeah, it's interesting. It can be a bit of a curse to break too much too early or even to have the perception that you have. Because then, of course, if the idea is for most people to sustain, you have one and done authors that do like one or two books in their whole career and that's their nature. But in general, I think a lot of authors have the passion for storytelling, want to sustain and have a whole career. So that hype can really be a burden that's hard to shed. When I started my career in my 20s, I had hype on my first couple titles. And then there was a perception for the subsequent half dozen that I hadn't lived up to my early ones. But I was like, in my hardest audit of myself, I was like, I think they're fine. I just think, like you said, the zeitgeist, it doesn't necessarily stay with you. And then you just kind of have to play it as it waves.
Yeah. And especially nowadays with the way that social media tends to run, I kind of worry that, it turns into this echo chamber. I often joke that Twitter's the bar that you go to get drunk and throw punches. And so for new authors coming out, if you have that happen to you, I found personally that once I sold that first novel, and that was a little insane. I sold it. I got an agent, and it was sold to Simon & Schuster in something like 6 weeks.
That's awesome.
Which is not supposed to happen.
Right.
It's kind of like that expectation is set. And I sat there in front of my computer for about a month, just terrified to start on the next novel because, of course, they bought two of them. And I'm like, how do I do this? This wasn't supposed to, to sell. How do I write a sequel? And that was, you think about how some of these debut authors will come out with this, where it does have that zeitgeist around it, and being put into that position of what do you do for your second book? that must be just the amount of pressure that's got.
The expectation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that is hard. You have to quiet all the noise. And then on the flip end of what you're talking about, and Twitter being like an ongoing bar fight, is something Al loves to talk about on the show. I mean, if you go all the way to the flip end, the current end of J.K. Rowling's career, she's now in sort of a sustained state of cancellation where she doesn't really get canceled because she's still commercially very powerful, but she's tied up in this, the transgender issue. So it's odd. It's like she's still a commercial powerhouse, but from a certain segment of the audience, she has a mark on her. And it's just like, and in the social media environment, it's just very confusing. It's like, are we supposed to like her? Are we supposed to keep our distance? And obviously Harry Potter is ubiquitous. So yeah, social media can be an odd place.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to phrase it.
Well, she used to take notes on her napkins. That was in drag bars.
Is that true?
No.
She just got in trouble. You know, she does the crime novels under a pseudonym. She does a series of crime novels. And one of the criminals was a transvestite, but only casually. There was only like one sentence in the whole book that indicated the criminal wore women's clothing. And then, of course, that just compounded the ongoing transgender controversy. And then, you know, if you look at it with nuance, it's like, well, in that particular instance, it was a transvestite, which is a whole different set of ideas. So,
you know, when I look at myself, we just saw Dress to Kill last night. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Brian De Palma. Yeah.
But look how that was, how a transvestite was kind of portrayed in that.
Oh, it's amazing. It's a shame, too, because it can be a very liberating, fun, exciting thing. But yeah, at that point, that movie's like 40 years old now. Yeah, it's like, ooh, he puts on women's clothing, so something nefarious is going on.
Yeah, he has to be evil. Yeah. But then I still get complaints about my one book, Beyond Suspicion, because it's got Russell Williams and it's got him in woman's clothing. And a lot of people complain about that on social media. So, you know.
You're also, don't you have one you're working on, or I don't know if it came out yet, called Killer Queens? It's the gay serial killers.
Yeah, and that's on hold at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I that's like a hornet's nest. I mean, but to me, it sounds fascinating. I mean, you're gay. It's fair game to go there, but it's I can understand. That's ripe for a spirited discussion.
Yeah, it's strange.
And, and also, Al, that the suspect I write on, Jack the Ripper, of course, that's what he was.
Oh, right.
So interesting. So we're gonna have to talk more.
Wait, so
oh,
was,
Christy, are you talking?
Mike.
No, you're
Mike,
kidding. This is great.
What's that, Eric?
I'm sorry, Mike. He was gay, the suspect, or he was a transvestite?
Well, he's actually a hermaphrodite. I discovered. And then he identified as a male, but he loved teenage boys, and he would molest them.
So he's a molester and heterosexual. It's interesting, these things, his orientation and gender, it gets conflated, but... fascinating, and then it becomes very delicate to talk about for obvious reasons.
It's a long story, but hey, Christy, you ready to listen to us talk?
Yeah. Now, Christy, I wanted to ask Christy if you've ever had, it's almost an inevitability to end up in this discussion when you're content creators. Have you ever had any hot water around any of your content or something that somebody found controversial or misinterpreted?
Of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You can't not. It's just not possible. The funny thing that I found is, the older I get, the more I see the appeal of having pseudonyms, for writing.
Me too. Yeah.
You know, just, again, just because if the wrong person finds that you happen to write offensive, you could it can get quite dangerous.
Ironically, I always fantasize about because I've done a lot of ghostwriting for women, so I always fantasize about having the pseudonym of a female and starting the books that way. But I could get in huge trouble for that if the truth came out. It's like even, but I'm just saying the inverse of what you're saying. But I understand the appeal in general.
You mean Erica?
Yeah. Yeah, Erica Shapiro. I think I can.
I like that.
Yeah. Nobody would ever know.
Yeah. And, you know, and absolutely, you know, as a, you know, woman, female, woman identifying, you know, author, I am absolutely. it's definitely something that comes up where, you know, and it's kind of funny and it's a little unfair. It's okay for me to choose a male pseudonym. And right under that, no one blinks an eye. In fact, with my first book, that was something they were suggesting. Because they didn't want to cut out the male, they didn't want to cut out a male audience. They thought, wait a minute, we think this book is going to appeal to a larger audience. It's going to be, you know, maybe we should go with a male name. And they scrapped that partway through. But, you know, it would have been, but, you know, men who say write romance and use a female pseudonym, that's kind of, that's frowned upon, but yet it's for very similar reasons. The issue that I did get, very minor, you know, it certainly wasn't a large, the majority of my readership, but there were three things that I did get comments on. Two of them were completely out of my control. One of them was the title to one of my books, which was in my second series, my Pink Age Strange, which was, originally I had, urban fantasy in Seattle. So a voodoo practitioner lives in Seattle with a grunge, ghost of a grunge rocker. And originally I thought, I was going to title it after movie titles. So, you know, plays on movie titles. So it was going to be Dead and Drowned Seattle was what I submitted it as. And when I sold it to Random House, under was Dead and Drowned Seattle, Pink Age Strange. And that title was not going to fly with the marketing department, sales department. So it got changed to the Voodoo Killings, which I personally did not have a problem with. That came under fire, as well as one of the covers, which featured an Asian, one of the Asian characters in the book. One of the main characters. And that just because of, and again, it was very, it certainly didn't go anywhere. I guess is what I'm saying, but I did see comments. I did get emails and comments directed at me. And part of that was, you know, I would say a very, very small minority was concerned about, having an Asian woman on the cover and, not having, having my, by a non-Asian author. That was a very, very,
oh my goodness.
But I did get flats. Pardon?
Oh, I'm sorry. How recently?
Oh, that would have been about, I guess that would have been when the first Kincaid book came out, which would have been 2016, 2017.
Okay, and it so never went to, in the culture wars period. Okay.
Yeah. It never went anywhere. You know, like my readership never had a problem with that. My publisher didn't get, you know, it never really went anywhere, but I did get a handful of online comments and emails about it. And interestingly, the third thing, and again, this was more of I thought there was some great discussion about it that readers had with me about the first Owl book actually, and it was not malicious in any way. And I actually, you know, as an author, I always stay out of this stuff because once the book's out there, I have nothing to do with it anymore. Nobody reads the same book the same way, you know. So I just sort of sat back and watched, but I thought there was a really great, and I occasionally, of course, I respond to emails and things like that. But there was some great conversation about whether or not one of the themes in my book counted as non-consensual sex.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Around alcohol consumption, and you know, me being from the university crowd, it's and that sort of 1990s, early 2000s, it's like, oh yeah, people get drunk, go out partying, and it's very much part of that college humor. And college fiction, I think, you know, component. But, you know, as the books, I think those books got released in 2015. And so by then there was more of a, I think, conversation about that. So, but that was it. That's been it. Cross my fingers, you know.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the words you said were key, like it never went anywhere, or at least in the case of the Asian cover and title. It's the never go anywhere. You never know if the ember is going to turn into a fire. And it's one of those things we have to deal with. I think politics is trumping culture in the current environment. And I think culture, you know, I mean, people have to respect culture and imagination and interpretation. And I that shouldn't be an old fashioned idea. So it'll be interesting to see where this all goes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a difference between insensitivity and sensitively approaching a topic. You can, I strongly believe any author can write about just about anything, provided they, you know, they approach it with sincerity, sensitivity, and, you know, authenticity, you know.
Authenticity.
You know, authenticity. And it's, but the opposites of those, the other things, is a bad place to go. And, you know, we've all seen movies where those three things have not been handled as well as they should have. And it's, you know, books and movies where, but mostly movies are the ones I think of where, sensitive, you know, topics have not been handled the way they maybe should have. And, you know, it's gone badly.
Yeah, absolutely. And things become dated too. I mean, there's a blind, you look back things that are older and you just see, wow, there was a blind spot. I mean, I watch comedies from the 90s. There's like so much misogynistic humor and humor about women's bodies. And it's like, wow, this was completely acceptable at that point. And it's garish at this moment. It's like, I, you know, and I'm not a censorship person or anything like that, but I sit there just not laughing. I'm like, oh, that's kind of gross. You know, like, so, you know, the culture changes. So there is something to be said for the monitoring that goes on, but it also can become its own sort of fashion where people are looking for a fight, like you said on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I think, you know, I was just going to say about historical fiction, especially when I'm doing Victorian, I'm trying to look for a contemporary joke. So I looked up jokes of the 19th century, and they were all the worst jokes. You could never see any.
Wow.
Yeah.
They're all, actually, in England, it was all about Irish.
But, oh, gosh.
So, but that was one thing that I couldn't use them all. I had to use the easy, the lightest
ones. Oh, that's, so that's really interesting. Yeah.
Go ahead. Earlier, too, when just talking about, you know, transgender transvestite and, you know, non-binary identifying people and that betrayal historically, you know, there are two movies that pop to mind and, you know, the question becomes, back then they were hits, but now you sort of look at them, Tootsie, of course.
Tootsie, yeah, which is a transvestite, yeah.
Yeah, because he, you know, it's, because he gets blacklisted, an actor who gets blacklisted, a very famous actor who was in that movie, too. You know, and the other one being, I think it was Soap Dish with Robert Downey Jr. And, very, very famous.
Kevin Kline is there, Sally Field.
Yeah, Whoopi Goldberg. Yeah.
Whoopi
Goldberg. You know, a star-studded, cast. And, one, you know, it's one of the punchlines, of course, of that movie is you know, that one of the characters is transgender, and that's the punchline.
I don't remember that part of Soap Dish. Okay.
It wasn't something; it was just part of it at the time. But you know, you sort of. You look back at movies like that, and it's like, oh my goodness, how do they fit into, how does historical film fit into, the world we're in today?
It's a really good question. I mean, also with that particular issue, with the transgender issue, it's interesting. It's like a Rorschach test of how somebody can handle the quote unquote culture wars, because transgender people are. And I'm not, this isn't even a hyperbolic thing to say. Like, there's danger. I mean, they have a high rate of violence against them, a high rate of suicide or suicide attempts. So to handle it, that really is like an alarm going off to handle it as consciously, sensitively, and like you said, authentically as possible. Like, if you handle that in a way that's flippant, like, you're really, you're just adding, you're perpetuating the grossness that goes on against that group of people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Christy, question about that too is: have your editors asked you did things like substantively, like say, do you realize that you have too many of these type of characters? You may want to add the female or male. Have they done that with you to kind of like take that into account?
No. I've never had those conversations. I've had those conversations in my own head when I've been writing. So where I thought, you know, do I have too many? You know, all my cops are male. Can I maybe have a female cop in here? I tend to do that myself. You know, it's to a degree, but I think editors are definitely asking those editors and publishers and you know everybody in publishing now and readers as well are asking those questions. You know, when they pick up a book, you know, or when they're watching TV, it's like, wait a minute, you know, are people being left out? Am I getting a, like you said, with the, you know, I thinking back to 80s and 90s TV with just the misogyny level that, you know, was there that you don't think of, you know, having grown up in the 80s and 90s, I didn't notice back then, but now looking back at it going, oh my God. You know, another great one from, before my time, but I Dream of Jeannie. Watching some of the I Dream of Jeannie shows, you know, in the 90s when they were on reruns and just my jaw dropping on how the, you know, the husband interacts. Bewitched was the other one, how the husbands interact with the wives. Just going, oh, my God, this was on primetime TV.
Well, I think a lot of it, too, you have to it's where we came from. You know,
absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
People have to realize that in the 80s and 90s, we grew up, you know, we're born in the 60s and 70s. And so we started from that point and it was much worse then. So.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's kind of a time of the signs too. You know, you can't go back and say, I think it's an easy pitfall to fall into when you're looking at any point of history. But it's a really easy pitfall to jump into where you say, for example, taking I Dream of Jeannie as, you know, or Bewitched as an example, the original series, you know, saying, oh, wow, they were bad for putting that on TV. Well, nobody at the time was you know, feminism and was, you know, still in earlier, you know, was in much earlier stages. These weren't topics that people were talking about at the kitchen table. We talk about them now because of how we've, you know, progressed. But it's such a tricky thing looking at things from the past in their context.
Yeah, and lot in the 60s, they had a different, you know, it was about race. And there was different issues going on, I think, in the 60s that created that atmosphere where the things like what you were saying, Dream of Jeannie and stuff, it wasn't the topic. It's how they were. Their topics were about what they were trying to change from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was just a different time.
Yeah.
But it's all good. I've seen it all. Been there, done that. 100 years old now. And, of course, you know, and Mike, he's been through even more, you know.
Huh? You know, what'd you say?
When he was going to science class, of course. No. Yeah, you know, but his science classes were a lot different than yours, Christy, because, you know, he was learning how to make the wheel round.
Hey.
I didn't realize Mike was on the call. I couldn't even stop with that.
He falls asleep. That's okay. I get my sleep.
You know, these hour calls are long.
Yeah. Get his beauty sleep.
It's also impossible to go forward if you don't have a past as a reference.
Good point.
You know, like society, you know, you don't have anywhere to go if you've got nowhere to come from.
Cause personally I get tired of people, trying to cancel out others because of something. And I think, well, you know, we're all humans and we're all hopefully trying to do the best we can and how we were in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's, you know, there's good people and bad people, but you look to the good ones and, I'm not, you know, I look at John Wayne, I don't cancel him out, but
yeah,
he was
yeah.
not a good person towards gays or blacks, right? So, you know, I mean, but does that mean I can never watch him again? Well, not that he's that good anyway, but you know what I'm saying? It's just, you just kind of take it as a big picture. Not, does that change how you write? Do you think about these before you actually send in a manuscript then, or are you cautious?
About all the issues out yeah. there. I try and do things. I try to approach things as sensitively as I can. And I certainly, before my manuscript goes to my agent, I have sort of a very close group of first readers I get it to, plus my agent, of course, you know, who reads my works, and, they do flag things that are not on my radar. You know, I've had things flagged before where it's, you know, and it's not that I've done something horribly wrong or written something horrible, but it's just, they've pointed out, hey, you know, this line you've written in here could be interpreted this way. You might want to be sure you want yeah. the character to say this. And sometimes you do, because you want your audience to think a certain way about a character. That's the other thing that mm-hmm. that goes into stories. Is sometimes your characters will do bad things because you want people to view them that way. But yeah, it's mm-hmm. I try to. And then, you know, of course, my editors will, you know, will go through, and I find that, you know, editors always pick up on things that maybe aren't necessary. There's also the question of, is it necessary for the story? And sometimes you will have something in there that is not necessary for the story. And that's where a good editor says, nope, we're getting rid of this. We're getting rid of this entire scene.
Wow. Well, we are getting close to the end of time, but where can people find you?
They can find me on my website, www.christycherish.com, in the library. I always try and get a plug out there for local libraries. On Twitter, at Christy Cherish. On Facebook, at Christy Cherish Author. And on Instagram, at Cherish Christy, just to be different.
Yeah, well. And you know, and everyone, send in all of your hate mail. Just go for it. No, it's certainly been a great conversation, and very, very interesting. It's always good to talk to other writers and stuff like that. And wow, you know, we've learned a lot. Boy, what did we learn? Well, let's see. That we need an editor to clean up Christy's work because it's so foul. And she says that she loves the big publishing houses, but of course she'll tell us the truth when we're off air.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of stuff here. So our guest has been the great Canadian author, Christy Cherish. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Has been completed.
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
How dare you?
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.